Well, today we are continuing a conversation about this world that we're living in, which feels like it's pretty crazy. At least it does to me. I think it does probably to you as well. A world where so many of us, it would seem, are really operating out of an old way of being human. It seems like we're stuck today in old habits and dysfunctional patterns that lead to separation and to fracturing of relationship and to hostility. And so in this series, we've been asking ourselves, how do we get unstuck? How do we begin to embody this new humanity that Christ has made available? A new humanity in which even loving our enemy is possible. And we've been using that language of enemies because, honestly, we all have them. And we do. We might not like to think about that, or we might not even like to use that word, but we all have people who we disagree with, who will vote differently than we will, people in our lives who dismiss issues that we think are critical, or who hold theories or ideas that we might think are unfounded. We have enemies. We have people who hurt us. We have people who refuse to make things right. We're really not all that unfamiliar with having enemies. And in this series, we started by trying to remember that if we are called to love our enemies, as we are, and maybe one of the first things we're going to need to do in order to be able to live that out is that we're going to need to remember our shared identity. That we are called to rehumanize each other instead of dehumanize, which is, man, that is the old way. That is the dysfunctional way, is to dehumanize, to dismiss, to demean those who, again, we disagree with or who've hurt us. We have to remember that every person is made by God in God's image, and that doesn't excuse behavior. It doesn't mean that we turn a blind eye to injustice, but if we can't see each other as human, well, then we're really going to remain stuck. So maybe this is an important first step. It's what we talked about a couple weeks ago. Last week, we talked about the way in which humility is then a critical next step. Because the truth is, there are times when we are wrong. There are going to be times when we do not see the entire picture. And so, again, whether we like to admit it or not, we need each other, and it's possible that we may even need our enemy. The story I think that we're going to look at today is going to make that clear, if it wasn't already. But this is what we've been talking about the last couple of weeks. The story for today is Luke chapter 10, verse 25 to 35. Maybe one of the better known stories in the entire Bible. You probably have heard about it. Maybe you've even read it. Maybe you've read it many, many times. So the challenge here, if that's the case, is going to be for you to try and listen with new and open ears. And I invite you to try and do that here. Let me read Luke 10, 25 to 35. One day, an expert in religious law stood up to test Jesus by asking him this question: "Teacher, what should I do to inherit eternal life?" Jesus replied, "Well, what does the law of Moses say? How do you read it?" The man answered, "Well, you must love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your strength, and all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself." "Right," Jesus told him, "you nailed it. You know, do this and you will live." Well, the man wanted to justify his actions, so he asked Jesus, "Well, and who is my neighbor exactly?" Jesus replied with a story. A Jewish man was traveling from Jerusalem down to Jericho, and he was attacked by bandits. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him up, and left him half dead beside the road. By chance, a priest came along. But when he saw the man lying there, he crossed to the other side of the road and passed him by. A temple assistant walked over and looked at him lying there, but he also passed by on the other side. Then a despised Samaritan came along, and when he saw the man, he felt compassion for him. Going over to him, the Samaritan soothed his wounds with olive oil and wine and bandaged them. Then he put the man on his own donkey and took him to an inn where he took care of him. The next day he handed the innkeeper 2 silver coins, telling him, "Take care of this man. If his bill runs higher than this, I'll pay you the next time I'm here." Now, which of these 3 would you say was a neighbor to the man who was attacked by bandits? Jesus asked. The man replied, "The one who showed him mercy." Then Jesus said, "Yes, now go and do the same." This story is a powerful example of the tendency we all have to categorize. To categorize each other. Humans are really good at creating containers and labels that allow us to easily and quickly classify and sort and rank each other. And we see this in this story. The expert in religious law, a category, by the way, someone who's a expert in religious law fits into a certain category. He wants Jesus to define another category, that of neighbor, right? Who is a neighbor? My neighbor. How do we define one? Who is in that category and who is out? That isn't the only category in this parable. We also see the religious and the wicked, those categories implied quite clearly. Jew and Samaritan, obviously on display, friend and enemy. And I wonder, I want to invite you to think for a moment about what categories you see in our world today. Might actually be some of these same ones, just perhaps slightly tweaked. What categories are present in our world today? And I'd love to just kind of catalog what you see in the chat window. If you wouldn't mind throwing in what, again, you notice, and I know you're aware of them, what categories are present today in our world? Give you a second to think that over and then to find the chat window. Yeah, of course, Republican, Democrat, right and left. Yeah, young and old. That's interesting, isn't it? Liberal, conservative, gay, straight, definitely. Black, white, yes. Intelligent and unintelligent. That is, they're usually not spoken quite so clearly, although sometimes yes, but implied often. Yeah, rich and poor, right and wrong. Generational categories, boomer, millennial. Yeah, those are good, Nicole. What else? Educated, uneducated. City, suburb, yeah, or city, rural, Christian, secular, yeah. American, un-American, very good. Coastal, heartland, yeah. Blue, red, right, yeah. Absolutely, Mark, yep. Pro-life, pro-choice. And just waiting for the Lions Packers reference. There it is. And I think we can call it good after that. Yeah, good. So, not surprisingly, you are, you know, quite easily able to name categories that exist today. And again, in this story, Jesus is directly confronting the categories of his day. And he's exposing the danger of categorizing other people, because I think here's the big takeaway, and we'll come back to this in a few minutes. But when we categorize on people and that categorization goes unchecked, in other words, when we just do it automatically and without any thought, it's just an instinctive reflexive move that we make, I think Jesus is saying that it keeps us from being able to love God and love neighbor. Remember, that's where this story starts. Well, you know, how do we have life in all of its abundance, eternal life? And man answers correctly, love God, love neighbor. That's what this story is about. And I think categorizing each other is a major, major roadblock in this fundamental calling that we have as Christians to love. So what we're going to do today is think a little bit about the ways in which we categorize each other and the impact that that has. And to do that, we're going to lean into, if I can get it, there we go, this book that I've been reading for this series, along with some others, but this has been the most helpful to me. The author is Christina Cleveland. Christina's a social psychologist. She was a former professor at Duke Divinity School, as well as other universities. She's now primarily speaking and writing. She wrote this book a number of years ago, really, I think 2014. So this is even before the 2016 election, and we notice the divisiveness even deepening. She writes about the disunity present in the Christian church in North America primarily. But the things she is writing about and the forces she's trying to help uncover apply beyond the church as well, I would suggest. So we're going to lean into some of the things that she writes about. And I think the first thing that I thought was helpful was that she makes it clear, she helps us understand that not all categorizing is bad. That there's a reason, there are actually a number of reasons that we do it. And one of them is that categorizing saves mental energy, which is actually a really big deal. You are, as we talked about last week, a finite person. Your brain is a finite organ. It can only spend so much energy. And so to save energy, to be more efficient, our brains instinctively take complex things and break them into categories and divide them into groups so that we can more quickly assess our world and move through it. You know, take something like the animal kingdom, incredibly complex, right? And we, well, quite helpfully have divided the animal kingdom into categories, family, group, genus, species, I think is how it goes, if I remember right. Right? We do that because it helps our brain to know what we are seeing, what that animal might be like, therefore, how we might need to respond to that animal, right? An insect is different than a mammal, for example. We navigate the world a little more easily because this very complex thing has been categorized and broken down into different parts. So it's not surprising that with 7 billion plus human beings, all of these unique individuals running around this planet, it's not surprising that our brain, in an effort to save energy and be more efficient, has broken up humanity into different groups. Again, I'm giving the positive side of this. We'll get to the negative side of this in a moment, but you know, there's some good reason, or there's some understandable reasons why we do this, why we categorize people. But of course, there are also some negative, some harmful effects of this categorization that happens. And Cleland walks us through a number of them. She says the first thing that happens is that this us versus them hostility develops as soon as you start creating categories within humanity. As soon as we do that, we get this us versus them, and surprise, surprise, we end up preferring us over them, right? Cleveland writes about one experiment in which researchers showed participants nonsense syllables, made up syllables, xa, yaf, gu, you know, right? Showed them these syllables, but then they paired these made up nonsensical syllables with pronouns like us and them and their and ours and we. And they let people look over these pairings and then took them away. And they then later asked the participants, hey, which of these syllables that have no meaning, are nonsensical, which of these syllables do you find to be appealing, or do you look at favorably? And not surprisingly, they found that all of those syllables associated with us and our and we were viewed more favorably than these syllables that were associated with them and their. It highlighted, this research did, the way in which we not only divide ourselves up, which might not in and of itself be bad, but we divide and then we assign value. It's not just that it's us and them. It's that it's us and them, and we are better, smarter, more sophisticated, right, more evolved, right? And guess what? As it turns out, human beings don't tend to want to spend time with people or groups of people that they don't value. So if them, they over there, have a less value, are less sophisticated, less special, less evolved, whatever it might be, well, why would you want to spend time with them, right? So already just creating categories and us and them, it creates distance and separation, right? That's one thing that happens, us and them. And Cleveland writes this. Just by categorizing, we often erect divisions out of thin air, create distinctions between the in-group and the out-group, us and them, and then attach value to the in-group, but not the out-group. These are the unintended but sinister side effects of normal categorizing. And ultimately, it's only the beginning. So us and them, that's the first thing that happens. Next thing is that we say to ourselves when we categorize, we say, we, my group is unique, made up of unique people. They're all the same. For example, if I give you the category of a NASCAR fan, I imagine you probably have a certain kind of person that comes to mind. Not 100 different kinds of people, but a single person who represents all NASCAR fans for eternity. So to make this flipped, and to maybe try and prove this point, if you happened to be on a flight and you met a 32-year-old Jewish woman from the Bronx, and you learn in the course of your flight and conversation that she's a lifelong Democrat, drives a Prius, is actually just coming from an Earth Day event. And then she tells you that every Sunday she is glued to the TV, never missing a NASCAR event so that she can see her number 9 car with Chase Elliott in it. If that happened to you, I imagine smoke would begin to come from your ears, because this person would not fit this category, this singular picture you had of what all NASCAR fans must be like. This is so potentially destructive. And I'll let Cleveland speak here. She says, once we reach this conclusion that they are all the same, and she says we do this quite quickly, we are no longer motivated to interact with or to learn about them. We think we already know everything there is to know. So we create this us versus them. We assign value to our group, but not to them. And then we imagine that they are all the same. They're a uniform, homogenous group with no distinctions, no nuance. We, on the other hand, though, our group, quite sophisticated, quite unique, quite a range of people making up our group. And this leads to, again, distance. Why would I interact with them? I already know that they're all the same and I know what they're like. And that leads to this third thing that happens. We know, we think, we know what they think. So us and them, we think that we're unique, but they're the same. And then we tell ourselves that we know what they think. Have you ever started reading someone's social media post? You get just one sentence in and already you know, you tell yourself, what this person is going to say, right? How they vote, where they live, what kind of person they are. You can make decisions that quickly. You know what they think. But not only do you know what they think about us or about me. Cleveland says, this is the turn. We not only imagine that they're all the same, and that we know what they're all thinking, but we know what they're thinking about us. And you know what they're thinking about us? They don't like us, right? We imagine that the Democrat hates us, the Republican, or vice versa. And there's no, we already know, they don't want to talk. They don't want to have us over for dinner. They don't like us. And that's like a given today, right? We know that it's a pessimistic viewpoint of who we are. And this, of course, again, only increases the divide between us. So we categorize people. We take this incredibly complex thing called humanity. We split people up into groups. It helps us navigate the world a little bit better. But the dark side is that it creates an us versus them hostility. We think that they are all the same. And we think we know what they think, including about us. And it's not good. Let me give you an example here to kind of encapsulate, I hope, all of these points, and then we'll get back to the story. I want you to imagine you're driving through a neighborhood you've never been in before. You're driving through a neighborhood you've never been in before. And as you drive around, you realize that you're only seeing political yard signs for one candidate. And it happens that the candidate whose yard signs are in all of these lawns is not the candidate you're going to vote for. I can imagine that quite quickly you might feel inside internally an us versus them hostility setting itself up. You might feel out of place as you drive through this neighborhood. You might find yourself not only realizing that you are in a different group of voter than many of these people, but you're the right voter. They're wrong. You're smart. They're dumb. You've thought through things carefully. they've just bought the other side's lies, hook, line, and sinker, right? This value is just quickly and instinctively assigned to the other group. But it's not just that. You maybe go home from driving through this neighborhood and you tell some of your like-minded friends that when you were in that neighborhood over there, everyone had a yard sign for so-and-so. When of course they didn't. Some people had, maybe many people had yard signs, but not everyone. But we start to make these generalizations. That town, that suburb, that part of the city, everyone is the same, right? We start making statements like that. And then we imagine that we know what all of those people are like, because they're all the same, and we know what they think, including about us. See, maybe we were gonna drive through that neighborhood because we heard it was a great neighborhood. And we were maybe thinking about moving, but now that we've driven through and we've seen some yard signs for the opposite candidate, we can't imagine living there. Why? Well, because they would never like us, right? And we probably wouldn't like them either. All of that, all of those assumptions, all of those conclusions that we draw could happen for any of us was really, really without much thought, without much work, without much conscious effort. It's quite instinctive and instinctual. And the outcome, again, is that we distance ourselves. In this example, I'm saying, hey, you might choose actually to not move into that neighborhood, which there's all kinds of research about how Americans more and more are choosing political viewpoints as a primary decision factor in where they live, right? We don't even want to share a fence with someone who might vote differently than us. It's kind of where we're headed here. Well, listen to this story again. A Jewish man was traveling from Jerusalem down to Jericho, and he was attacked by bandits. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him up, and left him half dead beside the road. By chance, a priest came along. But when he saw the man lying there, he crossed to the other side of the road and passed him by. A temple assistant walked over and looked at him lying there, but he also passed by on the other side. Then a despised Samaritan came along, and when he saw the man, he felt compassion for him, going over to him. The Samaritan soothed his wounds with olive oil and wine and bandaged them. Jesus is doing many things in this parable, but I think one of them is that he is directly challenging the way in which we categorize each other. Because again, this story has plenty of categories in them, right? It's based on the question of who's my neighbor, who's in and who's out. In other words, who's my friend and who's my enemy? Jesus actually adds categories to this story. Jesus is a masterful teacher and storyteller. He purposefully mentions that the person who has been assaulted by bandits is Jewish. He didn't need to do that. But of course, he does, because he's trying to do something, to say something about the categories and the ways in which we divide each other up. So Jesus says it's a Jewish man, and then two Jewish men follow down the road. And of course, if Jesus is speaking to a Jewish crowd, what are they all thinking as he tells the story on the front end? They're thinking, oh, he's telling a story about us. Oh, this poor Jewish man, our friend, our brother, beaten up by the road. But good news, here comes some people from our side, our group. And then, of course, we know the story. These two men, who not only are Jewish, but are religious, this is another category going on here, that they're the best of the best in Jewish thinking, the holiest of holy, they're going to stop And then they don't. And in that, Jesus blows up their categories. You think you have your own group pegged. You think you've drawn the right categories or made the right value assessments about people just based on the label that you've attached to them. And Jesus in this story from the onset is blowing all of that up. And then of course comes the shocking addition of a Samaritan, a despised, no questions asked enemy. And he is the one who goes over. I think that's a key part of this story. The transformational power of proximity. The first two Jewish religious folks who come down the road, the text is very clear. I don't, again, think this is an accident. Jesus makes it clear that they go around, they step aside, they try and create as much distance as they can. It's the Samaritan, though, who shortens the distance, who practices proximity, who goes over and gets down on a knee and bandages wounds. And I think proximity is a terribly missing part of our social and political discourse today. And it's not just political too. I suppose there are plenty of other spaces where we have an enemy and our instinctive move is to create as much distance as we can. And this story reminds us that if we want to live into the new humanity that Jesus is creating, if we want to get out of these old dysfunctional ways of being human, if we want to see reconciliation and healing take place, we've got to be willing to move closer, even to our enemies. Now, I say that knowing that there are situations where we have an enemy in our life, and it is actually the wisest thing to have some distance between us. That can certainly be true. But there are also plenty of situations, I think, when proximity is really the thing that God is asking us to do. What that looks like, how we do that, well, we're going to talk more about that in our discussion groups after worship here this morning. But one thing I'll just throw out is the idea of curiosity. Someone actually mentioned this in our discussion group, I think this was last week. These two words, proximity and curiosity. See, we make value assessments. We think we know what our enemy is like, what they are like, and they're all the same. We've lost any sense of being curious. We haven't asked any more questions like, well, I wonder how they came to believe what they believe. I wonder what's happened in their life that's led them to this place that they are at right now. I wonder what values are driving them. I wonder if there's any fear at all in that's kind of motivating or governing their decisions. We don't even ask those. We don't even think to ask those questions about our enemy. We just know who they are and what they think. Done. Let's get some distance from each other. But maybe one move of proximity is to begin to be curious again. Begin to wonder and to ask questions. Honest, compassionate questions. So as we close this morning, I want to invite you to do something that Jesus calls us to do. This is from Matthew 5. And he says, you've heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. So I want to invite us to pray this morning for a moment. And I'm just going to leave a bit of silence here. And maybe one of these phrases might be helpful to you if you're having a hard time even imagining praying for the person who's caused you pain or who you disagree with so strongly. Here may be some possibilities. But I just want to invite you to enter into a posture right now where you can be receptive to what God may want to say. And then to speak quietly to yourself, whatever is on your mind and heart.